Welcome to Latino Book Review Presents. Remember to ask your university library to subscribe to the Latino Book Review magazine and visit latinobookreview.com. Our guest today is one of the most prominent figures in the literary world. She is a Chicana and feminist writer whose career has inspired people for several decades. She has received many awards for her writings, including the Fuller Award for Lifetime Achievement, and has been selected as part of the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame. Her work has been the object of study of countless academic studies, and she's here to talk with us about her most recent book, Doña Cleanwell Leaves Home. Latino Book Review presents Ana Castillo. Ana Castillo, thank you so much for being with us here on Latino Book Review Presents.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
It's our pleasure. And before we get into your writing, I wanted to ask you about you. You have had a very impactful career. You are considered one of the pioneers in terms of Chicana, Chicanx literature, in terms of, you know, promoting and disseminating the lives and the stories of our communities. How did you get there? What's your life trajectory? How would you summarize your life trajectory?
You know, I always think, what point do you mark as the launch off point? And you could say, well, when I published my first book with the press, or maybe when I published my first book with a major, you know, publisher. But I remember being back at the university that I graduated from in Chicago, and I was giving a reading, and my mother, may she rest in peace, was sitting in the front row. And when I was asked a similar question, she raised her hand very timidly. She was very shy. She didn't like to speak English. And I had like no idea what she was going to say. And she stood up and faced the audience. And she said, she's been writing since she was this high, like, you know, as a little girl, which was true. But not only had I started to put early stories together, you know, as a child, but then when I became politicized, radicalized, if you will, in the late 60s and early 70s when I was a teenager. But at that time, the Xerox machine was come out to the public, and I was working in an office while I was in high school. I started to put together my own newspaper, if you will, or a journal. So I did that very early on. It was just something, it was an impulse that I had since I was a kid. And having said that, I will also add now that that was not my first love. My first love was to be an artist. I really believed I would pursue something to do with visual arts. So writing was just something that I did. It was a form of communication, a way to get the word out, whether I was writing a report on something I heard or saw, making up a story. Since childhood, I would not tell stories, but I would write stories. And also, since I was around 8 years old, began to write something that I later identified as poetry. All of that was just something I took for granted and that I did. Whereas being an artist was something, was what I was going to be.
So, and you wanted to be a painter?
Painting was something that came to me in my late teens. I took a couple of classes in college and so on. But it really, in any form that I could express myself, with any materials that I could express myself, was what I aspire to. As a very small child in my home in Chicago, you know, I didn't have any precedence. And, you know, my parents worked in factories and they had no idea about, you know, being an artist or having an artist around them. But my mother was aware that, you know, I like to draw. And so she would give me the blank paper from, let's say, from the butcher, you know, that white paper that they used to rot the meat on, which was good white paper, except where the blood was spilled on it. She would unwrap that and give that to me to draw on. And then she would open up the envelopes from mail bills or junk mail and give me that blank paper. And that was my first drawing paper. Which I used as with a pencil. So to be a painter, I've tried as an adult, and I taught myself to use oils, and I've done numerous oil paintings since then. But growing up and as a kid, materials and just the idea of it was very hard to imagine.
And you started developing these expressions, let's say, in terms of topics that at the time probably were not that common if we talk about feminist approaches, right? And you've mentioned a couple of times your mother in these few minutes of the interview. Was your mother a big influence for you to become a pioneer in feminist writings?
Inadvertently, I have a book that came out in, I think it was 2016, called Black Dove, Paloma Negra, My Mom, Mi Hijo and Me, about my mother and about my son and myself. It was inadvertent because my mother was not a feminist. And there's a distinction between being a strong woman, a strong female figure in your household, being independent, being the head of your household, and being a feminist. One comes out of necessity, and we've had that historically forever. And the other is a determination that women are equal to men in things that we have to do. We're equal intellectually and in capacity. And while we may not have always the same physical strength, we are also physically strong, and that we deserve equal respect for the things that we contribute to society. So that's a very, that's a determination that we make very consciously. My mother was not a feminist in that sense, but was she a strong woman? Yes. Strong in every sense of the word? Yes. And yes, that was a basis for the woman that I became. Is learning from her, learning about her fortitude, about her stoic attitude, so that even to the extreme, so that crying or feeling sorry for yourself is not an option. You know, expecting things is not an option. She was mostly indigenous, and she had all the traits that we associate with indigenous people in recent centuries: resourcefulness. Again, the stoic attitude, accepting the circumstances and making the most of what you have and providing for your family and for your community. So all of those things I did embrace, and I do think that they were basic for the formation of the feminist I became. I took it another step, and that step came in the early 70s during that wave of feminism and my intellectual pursuits and my seeking out women's voices around the world that were speaking and addressing very consciously those ideals.
And how about the rest of your family? Did they influence you in any way to become who you are?
I think that everyone that is involved in our formation as children and young adults and teenagers is going to influence us in one way or the other. I also give my father credit for my creativity, for that part of me that is social, because he was a very social person in his way, very talkative, very communicative. He loved music. To this day, even as we're having this interview now, I'm listening to some old school jazz, and my father adored jazz and played percussion and loved to read the newspaper every day. And I mention this because there were things that he would read and would just mention them, you know, at the dinner table, just talk about it. I was a kid, like, you know, in a public school, not hearing about anything in Chicago. And, you know, he announces, for example, I remember when he announced that the Amazon was being burned. I was like 10 years old in Chicago in the 60s. Like, what is that? You know, another time he said, do you know that by the 21st century, Mexico City will have over 20 million inhabitants? And I had not been to Mexico City yet. My mother was raised there. But it was like he would say things like this that would impact me. Like it was like a broadcast that I didn't know what to do with. And so, yes, he was a storyteller. And he brought stories to the kitchen table. And not particularly for me, just because he needed to say them. And I credit him a great deal for that gift. And my new collection of stories, Doña Clean Will Leaves Home, begins with a character that is really based on him, you know, where he begins telling his family around the kitchen tables a story that he repeats all the time, just because he wants to share this, not yes. necessarily because you need to know it or what he cares about what anybody thinks, but that he loves entertaining and sharing these stories, which is what makes the storyteller.
Yes, it's good that you mentioned your most recent book, Doña Cleanwell Leaves Home, published by Harper Via. It's a collection of stories. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the stories that you included in Doña Cleanwell Leaves Home?
Yes, there's 7 stories and a very, very brief prologue, which was meant to originally to be flash fiction, but the stories are long in comparison to anything like that. When I began to write those stories, they came very quickly. They were written over a period of maybe a year or a year and a half, and they were published just as quickly. So I haven't really had time to discuss them with people. And of course, we're in the post-COVID era, and we're not out and about as the way we used to be and have our meetings and discussions with other writers and like-minded people. I went back to early decades. There were places that were familiar to me, but primarily the motivation for that book for me as a writer was to go back to writing, because I was in a period of time in my life and also the world where I was really questioning the purpose of writing altogether. So as I began to write one story and then I wrote another story, it was really about returning to the practice of writing. Just as we talk about the practice of law, we practice writing.
Yes.
And we're always in the process of developing that form, that art form, and that form of communication. Because I had really come personally to a place in which I thought it was pointless for me to continue. And so when I returned to writing and started on the stories, I went to a familiar place, which was my past. I knew the 70s, I know the 90s, the 2000s, places that felt still comfortable. They had happened, we had survived them. And so I told stories, obviously, probably from a feminist perspective, about places and people that were working their way at that time through them.
Yes. Can I ask you, and you don't have to answer if you don't feel like it, why did you start feeling that there was no point in writing at some point? Was it related to the pandemic?
The pandemic came just after that time. I made a declaration in the early part of 2017 that my purpose for writing had reached its end. And that was with the administration that had come into power at that time. For the better part of 4 decades, almost half a century, I had been writing with the purpose and hope for a collective humanity, a place where most people in the world, male and female, ethnicities, notwithstanding, nationalities, that we would be able to work together on this planet for the sake of the planet and for humanity. And I know it's an ideal, but I'm a poet, and that's what we strive for. but when that occurred at the end of 2016 and beginning of 2017, I'm not proud of it, but at that moment I gave up. And what I had set my mind to as my life goal and purpose was to write no longer seemed to have any relevance. And so, I fell into a space where I couldn't see how or where or what would bring any of us out of it. Looking back, I still feel that I had a reason to feel that way. And I feel that I still have a reason to feel that way, except that I went too far to turn back. So I went back to writing. It's like I was midstream, like, what do I do now? So I went back to writing. First with poetry, I came out with a book in 2021 called My Book of the Dead. And then from there, I went to fiction. And that's where I am right now.
And we are very glad that you came back to writing, because you still have a lot to say.
Thank you.
And of course, part of that is related to this collection of stories in Doña Cleanwell Leaves Home, right? The element that I think that connects these stories is related to how the characters, they sort of have this inner search for independence. Do you see that connection in this book?
Well, we have this desire as human beings to satisfy ourselves, first and foremost, hunger and thirst and air to breathe, basic things. And as we satisfy that, we also want a place. But I feel we're in 2023, first quarter of the 21st century, that it's inevitable that we will always want more. Wanting more doesn't mean it's not bad to want more. So when we discuss things like independence and freedom, those are ideologies, ideals. What does that mean? And they're disputed. But with the feminist movement in the 70s, to feel free was also pretty basic. I was a young woman, a young adult, and coming of age at a time where married women still couldn't own things or have a credit card in our name. A woman of traditional background, like a Chicana or a Mexican woman, wasn't going to go live on her own, live in her own apartment or live with another woman. Travel in Mexico, I wrote a novel in the 70s called The Miss Kiwala Letters, and women traveling on their own were considered traveling alone. You know, it's two negatives. So there's so many levels of what that means. And so I think I just barely skimmed over some of that definition in the 70s, 80s, 90s, or 2000s in those stories of what it meant for women. But even today, even as we speak, in large spaces of the world today, women don't have that. They don't have that ability to be respected and be safe, not only in public spaces, but in private spaces. It's a reality. I don't know if I can even say it's lamentable, because we're not even at the place in which most people feel bad about that. So I addressed it because it was familiar to me. It was a facile place for me to work in as a writer. But I'm looking at now where we are now. Where do we go from there? So freedom is a transient word that is defined differently by so many individuals. And I think that it's worthwhile thinking about, because we're going to all have to face that question, I think, very soon and in the next decades.
Yes, I think so too, Anna. Thank you for that. And do you have a favorite story in this book? Do you have sometimes writers, they develop this attachment or some emotional connection to some stories more than others. Do you have a favorite story in this book?
You know, like all mothers, you never want to name your favorite child, even though you might have one. And I feel that way about all my books. I never say which is my favorite book. But like a mother, I'm always more protective of the baby, you know, the newest one. And like right now, I feel like my baby is the novel that I'm working on. So I have to protect it. But in those stories, which were, as I said, written strangely, very quickly, and they came one after the other, I could have kept writing along those lines had I been asked. I feel like every story has a facet that endears me to it for different reasons. So no, I don't have a favorite story, but every one of the stories is important to me for different reasons. The story then comes to me often, one, because I called it after one of my favorite boleros, Ven, and it's a story told about a woman that can't tell her story anymore because she's gone, and she was gone in her early 40s, and so she really didn't have a chance to go on and develop the rest of her life. That's sentimental to me. It also takes place partly in Mexico and outside of the United States. It's almost like a story about the things that could have been. The title story, Doña Klingo Leaves Home, I'm fond of it. It's the longest story in the book. And I'm fond of it because I wrote it around the time that I was a young woman trying to decide about the future. And it's such a wonderful time to live, to experience. We don't think so when we're 17, 18 years old and 19 years old. It's like, oh my God, what am I going to do with my life? But it's a wonderful time looking back on it because everything is possible. So everything is possible for her. And then we also get a view of her mother, who's maybe in her late 30s, who's still saying, because of the times, I can change my life. I can still make something of my life that nobody else told me I could have, but I can do it. So I like that story for that reason. So each of the stories says something that I personally was grappling for, because I wanted to find in these, you know, last couple of years, what do I grab onto that tells me it's worth pushing forward? at my age. I hope that younger people, younger generations have that, but I'm not living their lives. I'm not seeing the world from their eyes. I'm seeing the world from my eyes. And it's very easy to give up when you're older and you think you've seen it all. I went back to say, well, let me see when was I looking at life differently? And even though it wasn't perfect, there was something that made me feel like, okay, I can reinvent myself. We can find a new aperture, a new door in the maze or in the labyrinth to go through if we only have the courage to do that.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Anna. And if you compare your writing from, you know, the 90s, for instance, your book, So Far From God, to your new writing, and if you can kind of distance yourself from yourself, if that's possible, how would you see the evolution of your writing?
I feel there's always a thread in all my writing, whether it's fiction or poetry or nonfiction, that shows my, if you will, my agenda. My agenda is, I'm going to say it. I mean, I've always been called a feminist. I necessarily didn't go and say I'm a feminist, but the feminist agenda, however that's looked at, also as a woman of Mexican descent, Mexican indigenous descent. And this is really important to state in this country because of our history with Mexico, the United States and Mexico. It's important to establish that there's a perspective and there's a history of the indigenous and the Mexican indigenous people here in the U.S. with Mexico and what that is. It's not just, it includes color and includes culture, but also history. And so that has always been expressed in my writings, influenced by the current times. So in the early 90s, when I wrote So Far From God, I had just moved to New Mexico. I had no reason to be here other than to come here because I loved it. I enjoyed it. I felt it was speaking to me. It was in my destiny. It was in my fate. I had actually come from California where I had lived and taught for a decade. And so I came here, but it always felt familiar to me for every reason that I just mentioned. And so it was important for me to record it in some way, to write about Northern New Mexico in particular, the culture there, to record it, to document. It was quite a privilege, very important to me. And it was evaporating very quickly, the traditional culture. I'm also what we would say, I had intersectional awareness ecologically with our earth, water, and sky. This was important. And so this became a very important place also to document that and document it about people, traditions, and a culture that respected that. So all of that surfaced in that book, So Far From God, all of that sensibility and sensitivity. But all of it appears in all of my writings in different ways. My book, Massacre of the Dreamers, which was being written before, during, and after that book, also addressed those subjects from a critical essay point of view. I had written a book of poetry. My father was a Toltec just before that, and afterwards was followed by, after all, those books, was followed by a book called I Ask the Impossible, at which point we have our acute awareness of the Middle East. We're all connected. We're all connected on this planet. We're connected in our bloodlines, in the air that we share, even across time. And yet we never really look very far beyond ourselves. And we're always talking about our community or our neighborhood or our city or our town or our country. And yet, as a poet, I'm able to allow myself to step back and make those connections. And so even though I couldn't write So Far From God today, that place no longer exists, the place that I wrote about in Northern New Mexico. I was anticipating a lot of what we're seeing now because I always say as a poet, because I'm not a scientist or, and you know, an official environmentalist that can give you facts and data, but I feel it. And as I feel it and trust in it, I know that these things are things that we must observe and pay attention to. And so today I'm writing a very different book addressing where we are right now, but in some ways it's still connected with the earlier works. In many ways, in all ways, I think I'm always addressing the same urgent issues as a poet.
Thank you, Anna. And you mentioned the perspective of indigenous Mexicans, right? Or people with indigenous background in Mexico. And I think that's an important point because, of course, the experience of the Latinx community or the Chicanx community who have an indigenous background is different. Would you agree with that statement that the experience of people who are of indigenous background in the United States, there are nuances that need to be highlighted?
Yes, I had them and I felt them as a Chicana. In the 70s, we asserted those connections. We tried our very best at that time with the resources that were available to us. If we were able to travel to Mexico actually and do research or study there, or just read books and look, you know, things to see what would inform us about the things that we felt, which was, well, I look in the mirror and I see someone that looks to me very much like someone we would identify as an indigenous person, but where are the connections when I was born and raised in Chicago or Oregon or, you know, even California, and I speak English because Spanish was forbidden in the schools, but at the same time, Spanish is a colonized language. What would have been my language? That was a great project for the Chicanos to claim that. In the United States, if you have indigenous blood, you are invited or at least allowed to register those tribal affiliations. And then you can go and say, yes, I'm indigenous, I'm 1/4, 1/10, 1/16 of this tribe. But, you know, Mexico to this day has a great indigenous population. Nobody goes and signs up and says, nobody of Mexican ancestry signs up and says, yeah, I'm soy indígena. Well, okay, what else is new? So in this country, if that was your background, where do you go to make that official? And being unofficial is a very strange place to be, even though you are a U.S. citizen, not looking white, because that's what it meant to be a real American in my generation. Then what are you? Where are you from? So this has been a very long journey for all of us, which is being thankfully recognized by the Latinx and Chicanx communities, and they've moved further on. They've advanced that project, that agenda, if you will. Communication is more than we've ever had it before. Information is more available than we've ever had it before. So people now know things that were really obscure for us. Well, if you do look this way, what would be your indigenous roots? You know, even if you go to Mexico City, or if you know that your family's from Guanajuato, what does that mean? You know, and there's no records. Historically, we are colonized people. People were baptized in mass. You know, how do you find what your history is? So it's been a long journey, and I'm very proud of the courage and the stance of Chicanx and Latinx people who are asserting, picking up that torch, if you will, and asserting the pride that we have in being who we are, and not allowing us to be ashamed of the consequences of colonization, but making it a strength.
I think that's a very important point, Anna. And I have one more question, if you don't mind, before we run out of time. You mentioned earlier that we are all connected, and not only in terms of, you know, in a direct sense with our community or our neighborhood, like you said, but when you say we're all connected, it's everyone, right? From that perspective, that we're all connected, what would you tell those new generations of writers and to the Latinx, Chicanx communities as a whole, now that you've seen everything that you've seen, that you have written everything that you have produced, with your perspective as a pioneer in Chicanx and feminist literature, what would you tell the Latinx and the Chicanx community? Are we heading in the right direction?
When I was a young person coming out of high school and then into college, and just like all young people, you feel like you've inherited this load of horrific trash and, you know, useless stuff that the previous generation gave you, and they've made a mess of the world. And so then you decide with your youth that you have, you can do it. what the previous generation ruined, you can save it, and only your generation will be able to save it. And so you go out into the world and you decide to save it because that's your job, because you have all this consciousness and you know what a mess the world is, and you're going to save it. And every day you find new injustices and new levels of hideous exploitation and greed, but you can do it. If you are anything the way I was at that age, you put everything that you have into it. And very shortly, shortly meaning a few years, you burn out because, you know, one person can't save the world. And even one organization or one group or one country is not, and no country has ever set out to do this anyway. But, you know, let's just say a mass of people aren't able to do that because it's too much what we've inherited and where we're headed and what we do and what and how we contradict ourselves and each other and our hypocrisy as people, what we do and what we say and actually what we want and accept always contradicts itself. And so as an individual, my advice to young activists has always been try to pick your one pet peeve, your one passion, the one thing that you know that you can't accept, that you can't tolerate, that you can get up every morning and figure out how to combat it, what to do to overcome it. Have that one thing, because you can't save the world. You can't fight it all. But do that one thing every day so that at the end of the day, you can go home and be there for yourself, be there for your loved ones, take care of each other, have some joy, find some joy, be safe, get some rest, satiate your appetite, your hunger for food, for pleasure, for safety, and go to sleep and wake up the next morning and start again. If you don't do that, you'll burn out and be good for nobody, not for yourself, not for anyone around you. That's the alternative. So that's my advice today. So I don't judge what's enough, what's most important. We need it all. So pick your poison and fight against it and give it all you have. But remember that at the end of the day, to survive, you have to save something for yourself.
Yes. Thank you, Anna. And if you focus that question, but specifically to new Chicanx riders or Latinx riders as well, what would be your advice for them?
You know, we have more riders every day that have proliferated in the last 70 years with actual writing programs and teaching people to be poets and giving them credentials that make them leading poets and all the rest of that whole industry. So we have more than ever. But translating what we call poetry or all the variations of genres of fiction and nonfiction, and whether we continue to do it in paper or if we put it out in cyberspace or however we communicate it, the important thing is to be witnesses and to have our testimonies and to be honest about them. It's not about judging them or being clever about it, but really being honest storytellers. And so that's my hope for the future, is that that our testimonies and that our witnesses tell what each of us has seen in the most direct and honest way that we know how to do. And that's all that will be helpful to those who will come to listen.
Share our stories. Ana Castillo, thank you so much for being with us here on Latino Book Review Presents. Muchas gracias.
Thanks for inviting me.
This show is possible thanks to the support of listeners like you. Remember to ask your local university library to subscribe to the Latino Book Review magazine and follow us on your favorite social media platforms. Producers of today's show were Rosy Lima and Gerald Padilla. I am Hector Rendon. Until next time.
We can find a new aperture, a new door in the maze or in the labyrinth to go through if we only have the courage to do that.
Latino Book Review.